Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast that's going to be a little bit more sniffly tonight than usual. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir.
Yes, you are. So just to sort of explain that, folks, that while this is still indeed the podcast which takes a look at a film each and every episode, but somehow each film has to connect to the one that had preceded it, in this instance, I think it's safe to say that from a physical standpoint, Andrew, neither one of us is quite at our best. Is that fair to say?
I think if we walked out of a Richard Stark novel, you would say that we have been through the ringer or something like that. It has been, change in the weather, uptick in work cycles and that, and me and Dave decide to celebrate by getting violently ill most of the last week.
Yeah, that's what you get for living in Southern Ontario right now. So, we will do our best to make sure that by the end of this episode, you're not trying to, you know, your ears aren't bleeding from having to listen to repeatedly. But
oh, wow. That's lovely, Dave. Can you do it again so we can get a clean take and loop it? Lovely. That's my new ringtone.
All right.
On the plus side, I am proud to announce our new sponsorship deal from NeoCitran. Just like grandma used to boil.
Yes, you joke about that, but that was just what I was drinking right before going on air here.
That's exactly what I drank before going on air, too. Sadly, I was out of daytime, so this one might get interesting around, like, minute 30.
Okay, then.
So, speaking of an interesting episode to come, what are we looking at this week, David?
So, last week we were taking a look at a little Western called Johnny Guitar, starring Joan Crawford, Sterling Hayden, and one Ernest Borgnine. And, you know, Ernest Borgnine is such a prolific actor and one of the most, you know, wonderful actors of all time, I think, that we decided to follow him on over to a little 1968 film that isn't necessarily as well known as you'd think, The Split, Gordon Fleming's adaptation of the Richard Stark, i.e. Donald Westlake novel, The Seven, starring Jim Brown, Diane Carroll, Julie Harris, Ernest Borgnine, Jack Klugman, Warren Oates, Donald Sutherland, Gene Hackman, and probably somebody else in that cast that would allow me to put "and" at the end there, but yeah. I forgot to do it, so that's the quality of the episode you're getting here, folks. We apologize.
Gotta say, Dave, have you noticed your trademark that every time you're talking about last week's film, you announce the point of connection, and the one, in this case, Ernest Borgnine?
Yes.
That just made me think of how glorious it would be if, like, they ever made a movie like 101 Borgnines or something like that. Got all these cute little dogs with Ernest Borgnine's face superimposed running around.
This would either be the greatest thing ever or the most horrific. Then again, it could be both. So
exactly. I want some kibble.
Oh, man, that's, yeah, we'll just edit some of his choice dialogue from this film over the Disney animated version and go from there.
Hey, I like it. Mashup culture, 2018, yo. So I'm going to stop derailing this train. But yeah, so The Split. So we spent the last couple weeks, it seems, looking at Hollywood in a time of change, and here we're sort of on the other side of that, because as we mentioned last week, I guess, this film has a distinction that we haven't exactly verified, but by most sources, this was the first film to ever receive an R rating from the then brand spanking new Motion Pictures Association of America.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you'll find it in the IMDb trivia. I can't, as Andrew just said, we can't confirm that, but given the year that this film comes out, it is, if it isn't the first one to get slapped with an R rating, it is certainly among the first, because the rating system doesn't really go in effect until 1968. So everything up until 1967 was covered by the production code. So certainly I think from that perspective, this is an interesting film to take a look at in terms of the idea of suddenly we're at that watershed moment where you can get away with quite a bit more, and how what is pretty much a big mainstream Hollywood film sort of copes with that new freedom, you know, whether it goes full bore down into it or whether it's a little more tentative, I guess is the key thing to look at it there. But that's not the only distinction and reason to look at this film, is it, Andrew?
No, I mean, it's got quite a few things going for it. I mean, first off, you have a very broad cast, and even though in 1968, I mean, the idea of Donald Sutherland being the leading man, I mean, that's going a little overboard, but certainly looking at it in 2018, it's pretty much a who's who of who's that. But, I mean, probably most notably, though, this is also Jim Brown, former football player, who then segued into acting. Was it this or Ice Station Zebra? Was that his debut?
He had been in a few films prior to this. I think Ice Station Zebra may have been his debut film. But The Split was actually the first film that he was the top billed star of the piece. Which certainly isn't insignificant once we start putting this film into its overall context here. But yeah, this was Jim Brown making his headlining debut of a feature film. And I believe this movie was shot around the same time that he had announced his retirement from football. Now, I have to put a qualifier beside that because anybody who knows me knows I know nothing about sports. So I cannot comment on Jim Brown's actual football career with any form of authority whatsoever.
Well, take it from me, Dave. The man was a legend. I mean, not everybody gets that crossover appeal. Though I do remember seeing a film called The Black Six, which I remember it only because the ending is so confusingly edited, I actually didn't understand what I was looking at. But it's a blaxploitation film that stars six pro football players. Mercury Morris is one of them.
Huh.
And I just remember in the opening credits, it like freeze frames on them and it has their name, but then it also lists the team that they play for. And I'm like, so I guess it took a little while before we figured out this whole, you know, multi-platform franchising thing after all. But, yeah, I mean, Jim Brown was fortunate, though, because he was a big enough name as a player and certainly, like, high profile enough in sports discourse and fan discourse that of all the people to cross over into motion pictures, like, he seemed like an actual fit. I mean, he was an incredibly imposing figure on the field. He was a tremendous athlete. And, I mean, he also had that ruggedness about him that, well, if you're trying to adapt a hard-boiled pulp crime novel, you could do worse than a man like Jim Brown.
And I guess that brings us to the source material for this one, because this probably requires a little bit of explanation. Because, as we noted, this is based off a novel called The Seventh by Richard Stark, which is the pseudonym for Donald Westlake. And the thing that's of note is that The Seventh is not a standalone novel. It is actually part of a long-running crime series that Stark wrote, focusing on a little character called Parker. And the thing is, there's probably a better than average chance that if you are a crime thriller fan or a classic film fan, you've come across at least a number of films featuring the character Parker, just not by that name whatsoever. So what are some of the classic films that have been adapted from novels in the Parker series, Andrew, if you want to get us started there?
I was just thinking as a hilarious game, everybody who's played Parker, we can introduce in their terrible impression. But let's see, probably some of the more famous ones would be the film Point Blank, which that's John Borman, right?
John Borman did that one, and starring
Lee Marvin.
Yep.
And let's see, there's Mel Gibson in Brian Helgeland's Payback, which I'd like to get to, because that's one of those other films, like 54, where two cuts, two very different movies.
Oh, yeah.
There was one of David's favorite films from recent years, the titular Parker with Jason Statham.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I know there are other ones.
There's The Outfit with Robert Duvall from the early 1970s. And a one that I just discovered existed about a week or two ago, thanks to the podcast 80s All Over, Slayground, a British production adapting the novel Slayground that I had no idea existed and is, from the looks of it, is pretty difficult to get your hands on right now, at least in North America, which is unfortunate because I really now need to see this film, whether it's good or not.
It has the distinction of being the very first video nasty. Yeah, it's and I mean, like, for comics fans as well, in recent years, the late great Darwin Cook came out with a number of different graphic novel adaptations of the Parker novels. You know, so it's not that he's a beloved franchise character the same way that your Batmans, your Anne of Green Gables is, are. But, I mean, Stark's novels definitely have a certain kind of cultural foothold where, I mean, we've talked about noir in the past, but I would say that Stark is, like, more firmly operating out of pulp.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important distinction that might be worth going over. Just in the sense that, believe it or not, kids, back in the 1950s, you could make a living as a writer. And generally, you look at somebody like William Burroughs or Philip Dick, it's like they'd sit at their typewriter and just write all day and then send their stories off to magazines and that. There were all sorts of little publishing clearinghouses where they printed on the cheapest paper they could. You go to the pharmacy, spend a nickel on it, and then you get your lurid true police romance stories and that. But, like, it's a form of literature that doesn't intend to be art. And it really, because it's working, like, almost so far below the attention of the canon, that they can get away with a lot of really interesting things. Especially when you compare, like, some of these novels that were adapted by Hollywood in the 40s and 50s, and then you go back and read the stories themselves, and you're like, wow, they had to cut a lot from this. And, I mean, that's the advantage. Pulp, they never had to work within any kind of regulatory framework like the production code, which, I guess, rewinding for our listeners, was basically Hollywood self-policing so the government wouldn't step in and monitor their content for them.
Yeah, and the thing with the Parker novels in particular, I guess to give sort of a general rundown of what they are about, the key thing is that, as you might guess, they focus on a character by the name of Parker. And the only real things you need to know is that Parker is a career criminal, completely amoral, but an absolute professional. And the novels, I guess, in their simplest form, are straight-ahead adventures where the focus is, basically, Parker either gets involved in some crime or some operation. It may go through smoothly, it may not go south, but one way or the other, he is hellbent on getting his money. And that's usually the short version of it. The thing about Westlake's books, though, is that along with having a really, really sort of terse page-turning style to them, in terms of, like, it's very, you know, to the point and brief and only giving enough description where need be.
Yeah, this isn't D.H. Lawrence here. There's no flowery exposition. It's a lot more in terms of, like, a modern version would be like James Ellroy or someone like that, where it's the very staccato and, like, he walked in, he shot him in the neck, he took the briefcase.
Yeah, and the thing about it is that these novels are, the plots of these things are usually extremely well plotted, I should say. I said that phrase poorly. I apologize. But the key thing about it is, yeah, they're exceptionally well plotted, and they are sort of wantonly amoral, if that point hasn't become through clear. Because this isn't the case where Parker is the rogue hero, or the, you know, the, he's not the Han Solo type, the lovable rogue.
He's not framed for a crime he didn't commit. It's not that he, you know, his morality is appealed to by the one good cop or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly. That Parker is a career criminal. He has no bones about it. He doesn't really care what happens to others. He's just, he is going to do what he needs to do to get what is owed to him. And he will follow through what, is, as far as his code is concerned, is the professional thing to do. Not the right thing, but the professional thing to do. And get through with it. And probably most famously was the first novel he appeared in, The Hunter, which was, as we've noted, adapted as Point Blank and then later as Payback, where the general setup is, Parker commits a job, gets double-crossed right at the start, is left for dead, and then the whole novel is basically him following, trying to get his cut of the money back, which has been used to pay the mob, debts to the mob, and he basically has to repeatedly kill his way up the chain to get anybody to take him seriously, to just get his cut of the money back. Not more money, specifically just the $50,000 he's owed.
Exactly. What's mine? No more and no less.
Exactly. So, and a lot of the novels sort of operate on the same thing. And the seventh is certainly not dissimilar from there, basically involving, well, we won't get into the plot of it quite yet, because I think we definitely should start getting into the film proper and then maybe backtrack a little bit.
Yes, but stay tuned for our spin-off series, Parker Pontificating with Dave and Andrew.
Actually, that might not be a bad idea. But at any rate, so yes, this film, The Split. So the general context for this film is, as we noted, in 1967, John Borman adapts The Hunter as Point Blank, starring Lee Marvin, for MGM Studios. And 1967 is interesting because, A, this is, as we've noted, it's the last year of the production code, and B, you know, this film ends up being a huge, really significant hit at that time. And as the years have gone on, it's become, its cultural cachet has grown by leaps and bounds, I think it's safe to say. It's a thriller that has enough touches that sort of appeal to the art house crowd, I would say, to make it one of the more interesting crime thrillers of the 1960s. And,
well, yeah, and sort of when it comes out, like, you know, the idea of talented directors making pulpy stories is still pretty novel. So, I mean, John Borman, though, it's not like he's a guy working for the, you know, the Z-grade studios, you know, doing, like, the lurid cheapo film just designed to make a quick buck. Like, he's bringing a distinct directorial sensibility to it. And so, in some ways, it elevates the source material as an object of legitimate adaptation. But at the same time, it also kind of rounds out then-contemporary American crime films, because suddenly, with the production code giving way to the rating system, they can suddenly flesh out a bit more, if pun fully intended, but also tell stories that speak more to how some people actually experience the world, as opposed to how it's typically depicted on screen.
Yeah, so you would kind of think that, okay, with that loosening of the production code, you know, and the fact that there were more than one Parker novel by this point already, you know, that a possibility for a sequel to Point Blank would be the case. And you would be right, sort of. It's a little difficult to get the exact specifics on this, because finding information about the making of The Split is pretty difficult at this point, more so than I would have anticipated. But generally, producer Robert Chartoff, who was one of the producers on Point Blank, set about adapting another Parker novel, in this case, The Seventh. And from what little can be found, it seems that there was a point in time where the idea had been to make it at least something of a sequel with Lee Marvin back in the Parker-esque role. And we should probably, the reason we call it the Parker-esque role is because Westlake's always was only willing to give the name Parker over under the condition that everybody would be committed to doing a film series with the character, which never happened for reasons that I'm sure modern Hollywood looks back and says, that is ridiculous, why didn't you do this? Think of the branding potential.
But he ends up being a figure almost like Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe, who we encountered in Farewell, My Lovely. Just the idea that it's almost like a meta franchise where you have all these disparate adaptations over time that kind of end up forming like a weird cycle in itself, but they are certainly not meant to be connected or as part of one series.
Yeah, so at some point during the line, even though Chartoff was involved and MGM was once again the studio financing and releasing the film, a number of significant things happen. First of all, for whatever reason, Marvin wasn't back, and cast in his place was Jim Brown, who, as we've acknowledged, huge football star at this point, had a upstart film career at this point, and this was his first live action or his first headlining role in a feature film as a action star. And it's kind of interesting to note this also, because certainly this was of significance if to Chertoff, if no one else, because in a quote that I am not going to repeat because some of the language in it is not applicable in at all, to say the least. Chertoff...
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it.
Yeah. The thing that Chertoff notes is that one of the things about Jim Brown being cast in the Parker role here, which is renamed McClane for the film, is that in contrast to the major, the probably the biggest black star of the era, Sidney Poitier, Jim Brown, as far as he was concerned, wasn't going to be somebody who was waiting to hit a white man after he had been hit. He was going to do that in advance. So Chertoff explicitly in the marketing of this film was headlining the fact that, yeah, Jim Brown is going to be an unconventional, for the time, star in this kind of film, and that that would add a different dimension in terms of how we end up reading it. You probably wouldn't have used that kind of language there, but, I mean, certainly that's generally what we're going through. Which ends up making, which we'll get into in a little bit once we get through the plot synopsis and that, about how that sort of works its way into the film, and how I think that's been kind of overlooked in the years.
Because in practice, this is more than just colorblind casting or stunt casting or, you know, doing something different just to say you did it. Like, this is also a time where through the 1960s, you know, black sovereigntist movements and, like, specifically, like, black solidarity as a political project really starts gaining mainstream attention, certainly in America. And I think by 1968, the studios are also recognizing that, oh, hey, not every single person who goes out and buys movie tickets in America is a Caucasian male over age 30. So in some ways, it's opening new ground. But I think on some level, MGM's also recognizing, hey, there's a new market that's opening up. And if we want to stay afloat through the 1970s, we need to start, you know, branching out.
Yeah, and we should probably note at this point as well our usual caveat when it comes to these kinds of conversations. This is a podcast that's hosted by, you know, two Caucasian Canadians, male Canadians here. So whatever insights that we have are limited to our rather privileged point of view. If we get...
Take everything we say with one grain of salt and three heaping tablespoons of BS.
Yeah. But to return to this thing. So you end up casting Jim Brown in the film, in the lead role, as Parker, as McClane, the Parker substitute here. The film ends up casting around him a not insignificant cast of well-known character actors, if not outright stars in other areas in this film as well. Certainly, people like Jack Klugman were well-known comedians at this point in time. Ernest Borgnine, as we've acknowledged, was already a well-established character actor throughout this period. And then you have people like Donald Sutherland and Gene Hackman, who weren't quite stars necessarily yet, but were definitely working their way up in the ranks, as it were. I mean, certainly Sutherland was already working by this point, and Hackman was only a couple of years away from eventually doing The French Connection.
Yeah, and I think it's only a year later. Doesn't he win the Oscar for Bonnie and Clyde?
I think it might even be, yeah, because I think Bonnie and Clyde's also 68, or is it 67? It might even have been right around this time he won the Oscar itself.
Possibly. I'm bad with chronology even when I'm not having my body trying to escape from itself. Yeah. I'll stop trying to be helpful right now.
No, it's fine. That's good. It's good. Always be helpful. But also now, last but not least, sort of the final piece in this final pieces in this puzzle, you end up having a Robert Sabaroff. He ends up writing this script, and Sabaroff, as I looking through his credits, really didn't work in film that much. He was predominantly a television writer, mostly, probably most notably working on the original Star Trek for an episode and Star Trek The Next Generation in the 1980s.
Which blew my mind to learn, because once you see this film, I was like, from the writer of TV's Star Trek. It's like, how?
Yeah.
I mean, on the whole, like, this film, its background, it's like, there's just something that doesn't quite fit, because it's all these wonderful parts coming together, but it's everyone slightly before they were famous, and it just, it comes at a weird time, and like, you know, it's, it, and it's not nearly as beloved as something like, say, Point Blank and that. It's just odd. This really does feel like a film that's kind of slipped through the cracks in some respects.
Well, even things like the fact that, I mean, the director of this film is Gordon Fleming, whose son we've covered previously on the show, Jason Fleming, when we discussed The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. But Fleming, at, as far as I can tell, his biggest credits to his name at this point were the British productions Doctor Who and the Daleks and Daleks Invasion Earth 2150 AD.
Doctor Who?
Ba-dum-dum. The key thing about it here is, you know, those weren't, you know, mega hits per se on the international scale. I mean, certainly they were successful enough in the UK and had some distribution outside the world, but they're not like these were top-tier earners that would suddenly put it, I would see him getting pegged to be picked by MGM to come in and direct the follow-up to, you know, a pretty major hit for them. So, like, it's, yeah, you're right. It's not really clear how all these pieces came together, which is kind of why I wish there was more background information on what, on this movie and how it came to be, because, please, I'm dying to know how this all ended up coming together. But I guess having said that here, the short version in terms of what the reception of this film was, mixed to say the least. Most of the critics were not kind to it upon its release. I haven't seen any box office numbers, so, but from the sounds of it, at the very least, it certainly wasn't the hit that Point Blank was at the time.
Yeah, and certainly probably a disappointing result considering, you know, it's not just that, oh, hey, we have an action film that stars Jim Brown in it. It's, like, we talk about this film being an ensemble piece, but really, like, there's no way you can look at this film and say Jim Brown here is not positioned as a star. Even amongst the cast, like, he very much is still framed as the centerpiece of the film.
No, absolutely. So, I mean, in terms of that, yeah, I mean, the film, from that point forward, pretty much does slip through the cracks, and it's not one that's really had any critical reappraisal that I've seen at all over the last 30 years. I mean, it's not like some of the movies we've covered on the show where, yeah, they were bombs or at least, you know, interesting misfires that we keep discussing year after year. This film's gone pretty much unacknowledged and for most of that time, and the only reason I know about it was because I started release when it was coming out and wondered, oh, this seems interesting, what is it? And lo and behold, it's an adaptation of a Parker novel that I hadn't seen.
Yeah, now you get to fill up your bingo card.
Yeah, so I guess at this point it probably behooves us to actually explain what the heck this movie's actually about.
28 minutes.
Yeah. Like I said, folks, we're sick.
But yeah, I mean, in one respect, like, it's very much a typical Richard Stark, Donald Westlake narrative, because on one hand, it's very simple, and yet it's also, like, labyrinthine in another way. Because basically, we follow McClane, and he comes to town. He didn't just get out of prison, but he's come back from some time away.
Yeah, he's been out of Los Angeles doing something. We don't know what. He's returned, coming in over the opening credits, you know, starting with a busted-down car and then finally arriving by bus. Gets to a, you know, this little motel and starts talking to an old colleague, Gladys, looking for work and looking for Ellie. Ellie is played by Diane Carroll and, as we eventually discover, is McClane's ex-wife at some point in the past. And again, Gladys ends up sort of keeping, manages to accomplish both. She reunites McClane with Ellie, who seems still not entirely sure about whether it's a wise idea to let McClane back into her life at all. And she also points McClane in the direction of a potential heist, which is basically knocking off a professional football game on a day when it's going to be nothing but straight ticket sales at the counter. And because this is 1968 and there's no such things as debit and credit cards yet, this means, yeah, that's a heck of a lot of tickets to sell and a heck of a lot of money being sold by vendors at this point.
Well, as the poster line indicates, the easy part was stealing $500,000 in broad daylight. The hard part was staying alive long enough to split it.
Yeah, so as the film sort of goes through its early half, it focuses on Parker, or not Parker, blah, McClane, assembling his crew, first by pretty much going around and testing a series of different men with skills that he needs. And by testing, in the case, it's things such as beating up Ernest Borgnine in his office and getting into fisticuffs with him.
Which never gets old.
Yeah.
In the case of the, I guess, sort of the electronics and sort of like the lockpick man, Marty, played by Warren Oates, he basically traps him in a prototype saw room to see how he navigates his way out of it.
And then there's Jack Klugman playing Kifka, the driver, who Parker hires to drive out on Mulholland Drive and then proceeds to chase him and try and ram him off the road over the stretch of one of the most dangerous and notorious driving areas in all of North America. And then, if I'm not mistaken, last but not least, there's Donald Sutherland, who, in probably the most lackluster test, is able to turn around and shoot a mirror where McClane seems to pop up. It's not exactly the highlight of that sequence.
One of these things is not like the others. But yeah, so, I mean, probably the first third of the film, I'd say, is McClane meeting the gang and basically proving himself before they even know who he is. And I think that's interesting, especially in the context of, like, this film at least being somewhat conscious of Jim Brown as the black action star. And going back to the producer's quote about being the kind of guy who's not gonna, he's not just gonna pay it back, he's a strike first kind of cat. It's like, it's not that he's going around, like, smooth-talking all these guys and convincing them to work for him. It's like, before they even know what the job is, he's going into their comfort zone, testing them, and basically showing that he's a little bit better at it than they are.
Yeah, and while all these individuals are quite upset at this, once they are united by Gladys at one location and McClane lays out the plan to knock over this football game and then split the money evenly between them, most of them are quite willing to come around and forgive the whole testing by, in some cases, trying to kill you approach that McClane has taken to them, because they see the money. Except for, of course, Marty, who, as we quickly come to discern, is a racist. Quite explicitly a racist there, which creates...
But even he gets grouped in when they point out that, well, it doesn't matter what color McClane is, his money is green.
Exactly. And the film then proceeds, as you might expect with the heist film, with them basically, you know, getting everything together, pulling off the job, which involves pretty much taking control of the accounting room where the money is dropped off, putting it in bags over the course of the entire day by getting in there early, and then taking off under the auspice of being a ambulance drivers, and then, you know, hiding the ambulance itself in the back of a large truck in order to escape the authorities. And again, it's one of those sequences that's actually exceptionally well done over the course of the film. Not to sort of highlight things too early here, but that one's definitely...
Dave, we're halfway through the episode. We need to start highlighting
yes,
things.
Yes, but yeah.
But I would say, with regards to the heist, though, it's also interesting because the way it's presented stylistically is also quite different from a lot. Like, I'm thinking, in the context of our timeline, Machine Gun McCain,
yeah,
right? How there's the rapid cross-cutting across different locations. You got bombs going off. You got colored lighting. You've got almost like strobe light, quick montage going on. And like typically in a heist film, there's the idea of the ticking clock and they have to get in and out. Here, it's like they've set up their plan where they literally spend a good 4 or 5 hours in the counting room and everybody's just totally under control. Like, we're not watching people sweating under pressure. We're watching people navigate pressure expertly.
Yeah, which is probably one of the most Parker elements of this entire film, which, as we'll come to discover, does veer fairly heavily from its source material. But yeah, no, I mean, this is a case of, you know, they work like clockwork. They know what they're doing. They go in, they execute it, and there's no fuss and no muss about it. And, you know, that's, you know, it's different than I would say most heist films are, where suddenly it becomes about what are the complications that arise and hit the team, and, you know, how do they have to deal with them on the fly? And part of that's because the heist is only a part of the overall picture of what this movie is. It's not the climactic element of the film, as it would be in, say, something like your Ocean's 11s, or 12s, and 13s, or 8s. But, yeah, so the film from that point, you know, follows there. And then, from this point, you know, the team has to lay low. The person who's entrusted with the money is Parker, and he takes it back to Ellen's apartment, where he's going to lay low and everything's going to be fine until they can all reunite and divide the money.
Sounds perfect.
Yeah, except when McLean heads out. I'm going to keep trying to call him Parker every single time in this episode. But the key thing here is what ends up happening is McLean leaves the apartment. And lo and behold, Ellen's creepy landlord, who we only see in one previous scene, decides to basically go in for what we can tell initially seems to be to sexually assault her. What ends up happening, however, is, you know, what starts off that way ends with the landlord A discovering the machine guns used in the course of the robbery, proceeding to murder Ellen in what is one of the creepiest sequences of the film. We'll get into more detail on that one when we get into the sort of formal characteristics of this movie soon. And ends up just stumbling upon the money, which he proceeds to take. Now, from this point forward, McLean gets back, discovers Ellen's dead, somebody's called the cops to try and pin it on him. He escapes, and now he has kind of a problem. He needs to find who has the money, recover the money, and hopefully appease his fellow teammates, who, as the film goes on, we discover, don't necessarily buy the notion that Parker isn't aware of what's going on and think maybe that this just might happen to be a double cross of some sort.
Well, yeah. I mean, what are the odds? The 6 hours that you dropped off the money with somebody else, it happens to get stolen. So, yeah, like, the film, every little chunk of it is almost its own micro-narrative. Because we have McLean winning over the team, we have the heist, and then we have this aftermath where everything goes wrong, and then we get the introduction, and it's that weird little shift, because it almost seems like the landlord is going to be the bad guy of the film, which is odd, and then we're all of a sudden introduced through kind of masterful elliptical editing, we're introduced to Gene Hackman's character, Detective Brill, who we discover, or rather McLean discovers, ends up killing the landlord in a shootout, and it says nothing about the money recovered. So McLean realizes that this guy must have it, and he's sitting on it.
Yeah, and to come to that idea for the sort of odd structure of this movie, it's not part of it, I think, can be sort of addressed at looking at how this is adapting the novel, because the book The Seventh is structured quite differently, because the book opens with Ellen's murder right off the bat. The heist has already happened. Parker walks in to the apartment, finds her dead, and after a quick flashback establishing, you know, where the money comes from, the rest of the book is Parker working in tandem with his team, trying to track down whoever it was that the amateur, as he calls him, who stole their money and killed Ellen. Not because he cares about the killing Ellen part of the equation. This is Parker. It really doesn't matter to him, as he makes very explicitly clear. It just annoys him that it could have happened in the 10 minutes he was out to go and pick up cigarettes. And then, you know, the entire novel follows this almost farcical way in which various intersecting interests sort of play out. Again, there isn't really a creepy landlord, but this an ex-boyfriend of Ellen who is this insecure, you know, whiny man who can't handle any criticism and basically panics and does things foolishly right off whenever he gets into a situation. It is...
My ears are burning.
Well, it's the thing about it. It's a fascinating film in that light. Or it's a fascinating book in that light, because, I mean, it does seem kind of well ahead of 2018 and where we're kind of at right now, in that regard, to have your, not exactly a villain per se, because that would assume that Parker's a hero, and he isn't, but certainly the less professional individual being that pathetic. But the thing about it is, when you come to this film, it completely restructured it into something far more linear. And not only far more linear, but also shifting the emphasis so that whereas Parker is just a member of a seven-member team working on a plan that was originally designed by a character called Kifka, who's the Jack Klugman character in this film, Parker becomes the headliner of this movie and is the mastermind behind the whole scheme, as it were. And that radically changes both the way in which this film's told and what it means going forward.
Well, I would also say that another distinct change is definitely the tone, which isn't to say that this film is necessarily like moralistic or everybody learns a lesson or anything like that. It's still a gritty film, but at the same time, there's much more of an effort to soften the character of McClane.
Yeah.
Or at least as much as a film like this is really capable of doing. Because we're never really given much insight into his character, or any character really, aside from his interactions with Ellie. But through that, we can still see, like, well, one beautiful woman thinks that he's a good man despite his flaws. And certainly with Detective Brill, I mean, they end up having that sort of begrudging, like, gentleman's agreement. And they realize, going into the climax of the film, like, they end up working together in a shootout with the rest of the gang, because, you know, they're the two men that, out of this whole sphere of oddball criminals, like, they're the only two that actually do have any kind of sense of morality. So it's odd, because, like, the last 20 minutes of this film turns into, like, a buddy cop flick. But, There's definitely much more of an emphasis on making McClane a relatable and likable character. And that makes sense when you realize that this film is also trying to get over Jim Brown as a leading man.
Well, that...
Because again, like, the difficulty of adapting pulp novels sort of outside the codier is, cool, now we can do everything that happens in the books, but, as we were joking about earlier, but now all the characters are horrible and unlikable, and I can't unsee the things I've seen.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. I mean, you're quite right. McClane is definitely a much softer character than Parker. I mean, it's interesting because the way in which the film chooses to introduce him in the opening credits, playing to a really great soundtrack by Quincy Jones, is you see him sort of arriving in town on a very down-on-his-luck sort of way, which is, you know, again, his car breaks down, it's hot outside, he has to get picked up by a bus and make his way to this terrible motel. And it's, you know, sort of setting off as, okay, he's the underdog going into this thing right off the bat, and then you get into his whole relationship with Ellen, which is completely created for this film, because in the case of its source material, Ellen in there is just somebody as Parker knows for a couple days. They don't really talk. They don't really care for each other in terms of any wanting to have a relationship or anything such like that. For them, it's purely physical. That's the only thing that either one is interested in. And here, it's like, no, there's this whole history where something about, you know, at some point in time, Ellen divorced McClane for reasons, and McClane took, well, either whether it's because McClane took off or he took off because of that, it's never really entirely sure. But we get things like,
well, you don't stick around after they divorce you, Dave. Well, it's a rookie mistake.
Well, yes, but the point of the matter is, you know, there's a lot more attention played to the idea of this being a potential romantic relationship, while Ellen's sort of concerned that maybe she's getting played and used by McClane as cover for this scheme and hiding the money. You know, you get this whole love montage that plays at one point where you just sort of see them discussing their relationship and taking romantic walks on the beach while Jim Brown wears this awesome blue sweater.
And one awesome sweater.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I think also in doing that, though, it gives us a bit more of a reason to care and certainly sympathize with McClane, but it also means that Ellie's fate ends up having a very different sort of thematic emphasis when it does happen.
Yeah.
And certainly by the way that this film chooses to end, you know, like, it sounds like certainly this is one of the Parker novels I haven't read, but yeah, it sounds like very incidental and very throwaway, and I mean, in Stark's books, like, all death is treated that way. He's like the proto Kurt Vonnegut that way. But here, you know, we get time, and like Ellie and McClane are really the only two characters that we get to spend any time with outside of being a professional. And so, yeah, like most of the character building comes from that, and it gives us a reason to suddenly be shocked, as if the scene itself wasn't shocking enough. But yeah, so there is this tension though between Parker or between McClane doing what he is born to do and what he's incredibly good at versus wanting to also kind of have a normal life with some attachments. And there's that interesting tension in their scenes together, because even their moments of proximity where McClane basically like starts saying, well, hey, maybe I can take you back, and things start looking promising, like Ellie very quickly just turns around, like raises an eyebrow and says, oh, are you actually going to stick around this time? Like, she sees through him, and she is the only person in the film that McClane is even, like, bowed slightly by.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the way in which that notion, I mean, first of all, Diane Carroll in her performance, she doesn't get a lot to do in this movie, but she makes her scenes with Jim Brown count there, and they have to if you're going to end up buying into some of what goes on in the third act later on. But, I mean, it's also, I think, very telling how this sort of plays into the what the film is titled, the idea of splitting. And some of the clever stuff that's actually going on in both the script and at the directorial level. I mean, this is a film called The Split, which opens with the use of split screen and multiple perspectives and the idea of seeing things fragmented and broken down. There's that constant tension, as you acknowledge here, between Ellie and McClane about the idea of, is he going to split once again? Is he going to take off? There's the idea of, that's probably the most blatant reference in the title, which is the idea of how they're going to split the money, and also the notion of, you know, getting out of town itself. That's sort of very carefully weaved in throughout the film. And again, it's not like this is, you know, a, you know, deep, meaningful film with plenty to say on these subjects, but there's clearly a level of attention that's being paid to this.
Well, yeah, and even the idea of, like, certainly in the second half of the film, the when everything goes sideways, how McClane finding himself othered, like the group splits apart as well.
Yeah,
and you're right, like, it's not a terribly deep film, but it's an organized film. And like, it moves at a very brisk clip. It's 90 minutes. And it sounds like we've described a lot of craziness going on, and there is, but it never feels unfocused. Like, it feels like a very streamlined movie.
Well, absolutely. And, I mean, it's really, like, there's just so many little weird elements and details where this film is more interesting than you would necessarily anticipate for what is, you know, ostensibly, you know, a standard potboiler thriller or heist thriller, as it were, such as, yeah, coming to the idea of how this film utilizes Jim Brown as star. Because as we've acknowledged, yes, part of what Chartoff talks about is the idea of Jim Brown basically presenting a different type of black masculinity on film compared to the most notable individual of that time, Sidney Poitier. But it's also interesting, as you note here, because the crew eventually splits, the way in which there seems to be this pitting of this team of old white men who were stars of, you know, like the last decade and a half, if not longer, that he's surrounded by, and then potentially his stars who will go up to be bigger going forward, like Donald Sutherland, which, to be fair, did end up happening. It took a little while to get there. It's interesting how the film sort of pits, you know, Brown as basically the idea of the threat he ultimately ends up presenting isn't just that he's going to take their money. There's something somehow, quote unquote, emasculating about him in that way as well. And the way in which everybody, suddenly even people who don't like one another, this little white cabal, suddenly unites even with Warnote's rather despicable, you know, bigoted character. Because you get things where it's like Ernest Borgnine and Ernest Borgnine's Klinger is bonding with McClane early on in the film. And they seem to be the ones that get along best of this entire bunch. And even he, you know, betrays McClane towards the end of this film. And basically it's like, look, this is just business, but we're going to beat the living hell out of you if you don't give us our money later on. And that takes on such a weird meta quality when you consider, yeah, that this was supposed to be the big pitch to make Jim Brown a megastar at the time. And sort of how the star system was, or these old Hollywood stars were ostensibly being pushed out at this time, in a way.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that wasn't an aspect that I really thought about until we started discussing it earlier in the week. But I mean, there definitely is something to it, where the idea that, okay, well, everybody is fine and willing to work with McClane until something goes wrong, and then, like, they explicitly worry about whether or not McClane is someone that they can still control. And the idea that, you know, the other is an asset until it becomes threatening. But I definitely think, like, reading it in terms of what this film is doing in terms of its casting and, like, explicitly acknowledging that we're trying to promote a different kind of black action star, that feels more than accidental. I don't want to read too much into it, but especially because, like, it's not like Ernest Borgnine's star faded. I mean, he kept making movies for another 60 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, but I also think that the film is almost implicitly, like, maybe without even realizing it, like, because we have Jim Brown, who looks so imposing, looks dapper in that blue sweater. He seems suave and maybe not perfect, but he seems like an interesting cat, someone that you'll want to be. And then the film really, like, his counterpoint ends up being Klinger. Like, when the group breaks off, like, Klinger pretty much becomes, like, the de facto big boss. And it's like, yeah, you have... Well, it's like, okay, who would you rather be on the side of? Jim Brown looking menacing, keeping it cool, keeping it straight-laced, or Ernest Borgnine as greasy, nondescript thug, Jack Klugman from The Odd Couple, who looks about 70 here, Donald Sutherland, who, well, I mean, I love him, but he also looks like a total weirdo, and openly racist, jittery Warren Oates. So it's like, The film really makes it easy to side with McClane on this one.
No, absolutely. And I think it's just fascinating that that's the dynamic that they kind of set up. Because, I mean, imagine if they'd done this film where, you know, lo and behold, Klinger's played by Paul Newman, or something like that. I mean, then you have a very different dynamic going on in terms of, you know, how McClane is sort of interacting with these things. And I would imagine Klinger would be written significantly differently. Not that I think Paul Newman would have been in this movie. I have no idea. But, I mean, certainly, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, to put Jim Brown up against another megastar of the period. And it's another thing to put him up against Ernest Borgnine, who, you know, beloved character actor of the past 20 or preceding 20 years. And, you know, for the next 60 years to follow. But, so there's certainly that element of it that's fascinating. But then you get to other little weird details as well, which brings us sort of into the production code side of things and the idea of, okay, we're now suddenly making this, you know, a film that is R-rated. And again, you know, it's I would love to know how far along this film was, whether it had any interaction with the production code office at all before it was made, because certainly it would have probably been shot in 67 for the most part, I'd imagine. And if that's the case, I don't know at what point suddenly there was that flip where it's like, you don't have to submit a script. You don't have to submit any materials for it to be judged in advance before you go into production. But this film is in some ways very, as we sort of acknowledged earlier, very tentative in how it chooses to deal with things such as sex and violence over the course of it for large chunks of it. And then you'll have moments where it really pushes the envelope, certainly.
Yeah, because, like, I guess maybe point counterpoint. Like, there's that, the scene where things finally go south, where McClane can't find the money, so he pays a visit to, the Julie Harris? Gladys. Yes. He goes to see Gladys, he ends up being knocked out, and basically, like, trapped in a steam room, and basically being interrogated and tortured by the rest of the gang. And then guns go off, and what ends up happening is, like, you get this burst of steam that ends up scalding Donald Sutherland to death, but because the room is suddenly filled with smoke, he falls. You can't see it. Tasteful editing, yeah. Right? The same way that when McClane and Ellie are in bed, sort of, they reunite, they make up, and the camera keeps editing shots of their bodies lying in bed together. And it feels a little bit on the titillating side, but it doesn't reveal anything. And then sure enough, like, the moment that Ellie calls out McLean for probably not sticking around, she gets out of bed, and the only time that the camera pans over and shows her full body in the shot is just after she puts on her robe. And I really liked that sequence because, well, it feels much more like art cinema in that regard. But also, it's like the camera work is pretty much mirroring the fact, like, Ellie as a character is almost denying the camera what it wants to do, which is to look upon the body. So it's almost like it works diegetically and extra diegetically at the same time. But, I mean, we say all of that and sort of, like, the cleverness about it, and then we get to Ellie's murder, which... Well,
yeah, that one is, like I said before, it's easily the creepiest moment of the film because, again, you get this confrontation with her landlord, which, as soon as he discovers the machine gun, the way in which this is staged is this creepy back and forth where he has her positioned, basically pinned out with the gun aimed at her. She's pleading to be let go by saying the word please, and you get the sudden exchanges of close-ups between the two, as he's repeating her pleads over...
Yeah, their mouths just keep cross-cutting yeah. as they're saying please.
Yeah.
And stylistically, like, the edits, the move to close-up, like, that stylistically feels like it's coming from a different film.
Yeah, and then lo and behold, as soon as you see him fire, you don't see Ellie being shot up. You see the gun go off, but then you get the shot of the actor playing the landlord. And he has this utterly disturbing, creepy... quality where he looks like he's having sexual release at having done that.
Yeah, I mean, the way the whole scene is composed, like, it's hitting you over the head with the phallocentrism of the image. But, I mean, just because it's old hat in 2018 doesn't mean it's not really unsettling the way this film presents it. Because everything about him is so predatory... And the camera ends up mirroring that predatoriness during the scene.
Yeah, and it's James Whitmore, I should say, who plays the landlord here, Herb Sutro, there. And yeah, no, it's just, it's astonishing. And the thing is, it's bracketed off from pretty much everything else that ends up happening in the film. Because, you know, from that point forward, you would expect there would probably be a sequence where McLean eventually meets up with Sutro and takes him down. And no, that never happens. He's killed... off screen later on. So on one hand,
yeah, we get an edit via a newspaper headline. Like, it doesn't spin towards the camera, but it's not far off.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's very fascinating what this film chooses to pick and emphasize. And on one hand, I can see this being a criticism being held against the scene in the sense that, you know, it's, you know, really emphasizing violence towards women and, you know, fetishizing it in a way. And on one
hand... And as well doing it along racial lines, too.
Exactly. But at the, you know, there is that case. But I also think it's, you know, the way in which it's handled, you know, this is a moment of horror. And it doesn't feel exploitative in a way that something like, say, Last House on the Left is. Or, you know, the sort of rape revenge movie cycle certainly is. Because it's not overly explicit. It's not, you know, overdone. And it's not like this takes up and it's, you know, you're supposed to be titillated by it. You are supposed to be creeped out and grossed by what's going on. And again, kudos to filmmakers here. I mean, Gordon Fleming pulls it off quite expertly in that scene. And then...
Well, yeah. And it's a case where, I mean, this is one of those scenes that really highlights that, you know, when we're talking about disturbing things, like, disturbing cinema is more than gore, right? Because here, all we see, like, we get that incredible shot at the end as Whitmore's about to leave the scene, and we only see, like, the upper half of his body, the way it's framed. And he stands up, he's about to leave, turns, looks back, and then he throws a sheet down. And we never see Ellie's body until then. We see the sheet go over it, and then just slowly, we see one little pool of red form. And then we see about six or seven more. And it's like, again, it's the classic horror dodge of don't show people what they're supposed to be afraid of. Just give them a hint, and then they'll make it so much worse in their brains. Like... It's tasteful in that sense, but I mean, the scene itself, it's just, we are privy to a complete and total power imbalance that ends up with a woman who's completely helpless in this situation pleading not to be murdered before she's murdered by a guy that we were literally just introduced to. Like, we see him in the background every time that McLean leaves the apartment, but it's not like he's developed as a character. So the moment he walks in and starts licking his lips and saying, you know, I'd let you live here for free, like, you immediately know where it's going, yeah. But it gets so much worse than that. Because you almost expect, like, McLean's going to show up and kill him, and then Ellie's going to be horrified or something, and then forces him to decide between, like, crime and her or something. That doesn't happen. She does not get rescued. Well, and that's pretty unnerving.
Well, that's exactly. And what's also more interesting is, in the case of the book, even though it is the event that opens the novel, and, you know, from which the rest of the book sort of spirals out of, in the case of this film, or in the case of the book, it's really, I mean, again, it's glossed over in the sense that none of the protagonists really care that much about it. It's an incident that's annoying them and frustrating them because of the fact that it resulted in the loss of the money, but none of them seem to really treat, even the police in the novel, don't seem to really care that much about the notion of catching her killer so much as they want to catch the people who committed the robbery, because there's more glory to go with that. In the case of this film, though, even though, yeah, her murder is never quite central either, it's not forgotten in the same way, and certainly that's the case when you reach the end of the film, when it closes on this very peculiar moment where, after the gang has been dispatched, after Brill and McLean have gone their separate ways, having split the money from the robbery, what ends up happening is you see McLean once again about to leave town, this time in a much more high-class fashion. He's going to take off in an airplane. He's in a well-tailored suit. Everything seems to be going. And just as you see him about to sort of walk down towards, to get onto the plane, you just hear, you know, on the track, the name McLean said by Ellen. And you just see him turn around and this freeze frame on his face as it closes. And you're the one, Andrew, who sort of made note about that it's such a peculiar shot and a peculiar choice to end this movie on.
Well, yeah, and like, because this is a film that, again, it's very straightforward. Like, it's not art house in the way that something like Antonioni's Blow Up is, where you're sort of taking art house aesthetics and applying them to, like, mod culture, right? It's like, this is a distinctly Hollywood film in many respects, but, like, then you get things like the sequence between Ellie and the landlord, where it's just, where is this coming from? And, yeah, like, I was just so surprised by the fact that they decide to end this film in this way. And only because by ending on Ellie basically calling to Parker, whether it's memory, whether it's beyond the grave, whether it's regret, or, you know, trying to bring up some kind of argument about, like, well, you gained a fortune, but at what cost, or something along those lines. Like, he just hears it, and then it freezes. So there's no moment for reflection, no time for that to develop into anything. It's almost like the film is just trying to remind us that, oh, by the way, Ellie was a character in the first 50 minutes of this film. Because it's like, again, going back to Machine Gun McCain, where we have so much of the film, and only in the last 10 minutes it decides to be about, like, the futility of trying to change your ways. And it's like, wait, that's what this film's supposed to be about? I had a similar feeling with this, where by ending on that note, I feel like it suggests that is really what sort of, I guess, the thematic emphasis of this film should be. And I'm still just having a lot of difficulty figuring why did they do it that way.
See, to me, I think it feels thematically of a piece with the rest of the movie, in the sense that, again, we are this idea of the split, the splitting and getting away, Well, yeah, in this case, McLean is going to split. He's going to get out of town, and he's, you know, obviously he's been split from Ellie. But I think on one hand, it functions as both a reminder that, you know, that idea of splitting off, of taking off, and having an even divide, it's not that clean. There's always going to be something that sort of keeps things tangentially together in some way, shape, or form. But also the fact that, yeah, this, in the case of McLean, he bears responsibility for what's happened in this instance here. I mean, unlike, say, the actual Parker character from the books, who somebody pointed to him, it's like, well, this is your fault, and he would probably shrug, go, whatever, and not care one way or the other. His fault, not his fault, doesn't matter at the end of the day, he's still kicking. In the case of McLean, there is that sense that, yeah, he's got to bear responsibility for the fact that, yeah, he did kind of use her. Yeah, he's, you know, that split that maybe could have been reconciled when he returned can't happen now. That's not something that's a possibility. So to me, I mean, I may be giving him way too much credit with this ending. I'm not going to lie. Certainly, I'm not going to.
Well, it's plausible anyway.
Yeah.
It's just because the film ends on that very abrupt note. You know, it doesn't even freeze and then go into a montage of, like, you know, McLean ended up being elected to the Georgia House of Representatives or something. Yeah. And Detective Brill ended up being promoted to captain. You know, it's nothing like that. Like, that's literally where the film cuts off. And as a result, like, it's just, it's confusing to me because it's like, okay, well, so we end thinking about Ellie. And it's like, well, are we thinking about her in terms of, like, regret and what has been lost? Are we, you know, remembering her as, like, you know, the way that McLean failed her? Or is it that final, like, almost jettisoning her from his brain before he gets on the plane and makes that split? Like, I feel like that is one area where this film stumbles, only because, like, they're trying to do something, but it's not entirely clear what they're trying to do. They just happen to end the film on this failed attempt.
And that's fair, yeah. I mean, certainly, I mean, as much credit as I think we're giving this film, that none of what we're saying here is to say that this is a perfect movie, because I think there are a number of little nitpicks we can bring up, and I think, as much as I think we admire elements of the peculiar structure of this movie, and it's almost, you know, division into different sort of episodic chunks, there is also something about the fact that, yeah, the structure is perhaps a bit clunky as well, going forward, or going throughout it.
Well, yeah, because in practice, I mean, the transitions from sort of, like, segment to segment aren't exactly that neat. So even though it's kind of clever in, because, like, when we talk about art film style, like, there's, well, elliptical editing is one, where all of a sudden there's a cut between scenes, and then we realize, oh, these scenes are actually taking place, like, years apart, and there's all this time missing. Here, we end up getting those elliptical edits, but it's still very Hollywood, where it's done in a way that preserves narrative economy. So instead of having to have, like, a 10-minute scene of them tracking down the landlord, killing him, and Brill finding the money, instead, it's literally, oh, well, I mentioned the landlord in this scene, newspaper on the desk. But the result of that is we have the Ellie's death scene that really emphasizes, like, just the villainy of this weird landlord, but we're also denied any kind of retribution or a sense of justice. Like, we know he's dead, but considering how, like, visually intricate that scene is and how voyeuristic that scene comes across, when we find out that this guy's payback was just being killed by the police off screen and with no detail, it doesn't feel satisfying. Instead, it's just like, well, why did they put all this time and attention into setting up that sequence if nothing stems from it other than a plot?
And it's interesting, because on one hand, I think you could also make the argument that maybe that's kind of the point. I mean, the way in which, in the, you know, in the mechanics of everybody's very narrow point of view, she is forgotten amongst it. But yeah, the way in which it plays out, I mean, that could just simply be an accidental reading rather than this was a deliberate attempt on our part to achieve that feeling, or we are making some sort of commentary about the way in which the murders of women, and particularly marginalized women, are sort of pushed to the edges and overlooked in our culture, in a way, and devalued in our culture. So, I mean, it's very peculiar in that sense, and I honestly don't have any sort of real definitive thoughts as to what the film does or does not achieve on that level.
Yeah. I mean, but by that same token, though, like, it's weird because, like, even the climax itself is fairly unspectacular in that, like, most of the climax, it's shot well at the train yard where, on one side you have Brill and McLean that are going to basically divvy up the money, get their share, but they also know that they're probably walking into a trap. And sure enough, they're greeted by three guys setting a trap for them. And it, like, instead of like a tense standoff or having to pick sides or anything like that or calling back to themes, instead it's just, okay, well, you go over there and shoot anyone who comes at you, and I'm going to go over here and flush them out. And that's exactly what happens. The three, I guess, worst bad guys, they all end up getting gunned down. No big speeches. There's no bravura to it. And I guess I feel like that's kind of a shame, given how this is a film where you can show like 15 minutes of people sitting in an office at gunpoint, and it's still exciting.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's probably, I would say probably accounts for some of why this film likely wasn't well received at the time. Because certainly, again, looking at what Borman pulls off in Point Blank a year earlier, stylistically, that film is more consistent throughout in terms of what it achieves, and is certainly more striking throughout the entirety of its running time. This one, yeah, it's intermittently really hit some high notes. It just never quite manages to sustain that throughout the entirety of its 90-minute running time. Which doesn't take away from those notes, it just means, you know, certainly it's like at other points you're dealing with a fairly conventionally shot and made thriller. But it almost feels like we've now just sort of talked ourselves into a corner where it's like, well, maybe this film wasn't as good as we're making it out to be at the start.
Well, it's more, I think it's a case where this, if you look at this film and you look at pulp novels in general, there's a way I think that we can sort of bracket this off, where I'm not going to pretend that when Donald West, like, sat down and wrote any of the Parker novels, he wanted to make a greater statement about society and its treatment of women or anything like that. And the same way that I don't think that's what the producers of this film wanted to do. If anything, by their own statements, like, the real idea here is make Jim Brown a star. And everything else that happened is just, it's totally incidental. And that the weird alignment between the camera as something that Ellie can repel, but then eventually gets victimized by, like, that's, it's intricate, but I also feel like that's a very after-the-fact reading. So, I mean, to fault this film for being confused about statements that it's not even really trying to make, I think we can forgive.
No, and that's fair. And I mean, that's ultimately the case. I mean, it's a well enough made pulp film from 1968. It's,
yeah, 50 years ago. So, well, not to say, again, as we've said before, historically contextualized misogyny is still misogyny, but I mean, there's also a question of how much we expect from a pulp novel adaptation in 1968.
Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, with that, I guess, is there anything we really haven't touched upon in the last 75 minutes, Andrew, that we should go into depth here? Or should we sort of segue our way towards the hits and pits segment of this program?
Well, seeing as we began our conversation kind of foregrounding it, we sort of got away from it. But you had mentioned earlier that in the split, Jim Brown being a black character, that's not just accidental, that this film actually sort of gets wow, completely lost my train of thought there. What am I trying to say? You were saying something that, like, it's not that they could have cast anybody in the McLean role, that there are elements where you see, like, it was specifically written for him as a black individual. I'm wondering if you could speak a bit more.
Well, not just him as a black individual, because certainly I think the film, in the way in which, as we sort of already acknowledged, the way in which it casts around Jim Brown, and the way in which, you know, suddenly, you know, the character of Marty is explicitly a racist, that's stuff you won't necessarily find in the original text, because Parker in that is presented as a white character. So on some level, there is this open acknowledgement that, yes, McClane, you know, is a black man, a black American living in America as it is in 1968, and it's not overlooking that fact. But there's also the fact that, you know, this is Jim Brown, football star, and while I certainly don't know much about football and Jim Brown's career, I think it's very clear that a lot of what's going on in this film is tailor-made to try and appeal to that crossover audience. Because coming back to the original, The Seventh, the novel it's based off of, the nature of the heist that goes on is ostensibly the same. What differs is scale. In the case of the novel, it's basically a university or college game. Just the sort of local thing that's going to bring in around $100,000, and everybody who's part of the team is going to walk away with a seventh of that amount of money, which is, you know, not retirement money, but it's a decent chunk of change. In the case of this film, as part of its either Hollywoodization and partly built around Jim Brown, the football element of the text is really strongly emphasized. Because again, the heist, which is this, you know, single chapter in the course of a book, is suddenly its own sequence onto itself. This is taking up probably a substantial 10 to 15 minutes of screen time to get through that entire sequence of the movie. And yeah, it's built, they amp it up so it's an NFL game they are going to be swiping, you know, the funds from. You know, it's going to be, you know, demonstrating an actual football game going on screen while this is happening.
And I'm sure it didn't hurt having Jim Brown in your film just for navigating the rights on things like that.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, there's this way in which it's definitely amping up the notion of how significant football is into the film. And to come back to this notion of even how it frames Jim Brown's masculinity in the course of this film. As we were talking about earlier, you know, the film is very selective in terms of, and suggestive when it comes to how it deals with sexuality when it comes to Diane Carroll's character. You know, they don't display her body. They hint towards things, but they never explicitly show it. While certainly we don't get something like a full-on, fully nude Jim Brown scene in this movie, the film does, I mean, the way in which Gordon Fleming stages sequences when he's with Ellen, yeah, Jim Brown's, you know, walking around shirtless in these scenes, and a lot of emphasis is put upon his physicality. The fact that, by the way, here is, you know, take a look at him, admire him in this case. Now, that's a very loaded thing to do for a whole variety of reasons.
Yeah, I was going to say that very double-edged sword there when you're putting black bodies on display. But in this case, though, I think it doesn't necessarily feel like voyeuristic in a cheap way. It's not so much like, oh, look at this crazy other. It's just, wow, look at the size of his muscles up close.
Well,
Jim Brown's a handsome man.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, like, they're very much selling it as, you know, Jim Brown's sex symbol more than anything else here. But I think it also matters when you, again, who is, you know, the, you know, as we've acknowledged previous thing, the quote-unquote machoest member of the team, aside from him, is Ernest Borgnine. And, I mean, they introduce him as a, you know, a guy running a gym, of all things. And look, no, to, you know, not to slam Ernest Borgnine, but the man is not is by no stretch of accounts, you know, the top physical specimen in 1968. I think it's fair to say at that time.
I mean, he was 45 years old when he was born. So, I mean, yeah.
But
it's just, but yeah, like, I'm just also thinking, like, as well, because, yeah, as you brought up Warren Oates' character, like, well, I mean, unless McClane was a black character, him being racist isn't a problem. But otherwise, like, the only other thing I can really think of, because even the dialogue with Ellie, like, the idea of blackness isn't addressed, and not saying it has to be, but I mean, like, it feels like kind of interchangeable dialogue. The only other thing I can point to, though, is at the end when they're setting the trap in the train yard, and, like, they're basically, one of us has to go and be, go sneak up on them. And Brill looks at McClane and says, well, you should do it. It'll be easier. It's dark out. You'll disguise better. And, like, but he says it, and the two share a smile and a little laugh over it. But, I mean, like, otherwise, I'm like, I think, honestly, in some respects, like, the biggest way that Jim Brown's blackness contributes to the film is I guess let me put it to you this way. Would they have an incredible funk score by Quincy Jones if they had just cast a bunch of white dudes in this movie?
Well, it's interesting you say, because again, we go back a few episodes ago and Jones wrote the score for Mirage. And
very good point.
And the thing about it is, but I would say to what you're pointing out here as well, is when you look at Mirage and you listen to the score, it's not what I think a lot of people automatically assume when you think of a Quincy Jones score. There are bits and
it's decidedly more jazzy than funk.
Well, that's the thing. And you get to this film, which is only a few years later, and yeah, it's more true of what I think a lot of people have the popular perception of Quincy Jones's work as being. And so on one hand, it feels like it feels, I would almost want to say in a certain way, that the film is gesturing towards what would eventually become blaxploitation cinema in that way, with the idea of, you know, using what at least Hollywood assumes to be, you know, elements of black culture and black identity as part of its film and exploiting that for financial gain. And probably in this film, it's tricky to say, because I get the feeling that, probably Quincy Jones was, in some ways, was probably viewed as, okay, that might be a tie-in to the fact that this is going to be a film headlined by a black star. But I don't know. I mean, it's really tricky to sort of navigate this, because I don't know what to say about this, and I really don't feel like I have the ability to make any sort of nuanced insight on this, either, you know, culturally or historically, because...
Well, yeah. I mean, we want to unpack this, but at the same time, we also don't want to piss people off by just saying things ignorantly. And I mean, yeah, like, I think maybe in some of the episodes to come, this might be a theme worth coming back to, or sort of reading it contextually against other films that really foreground black performers in it. Because, I mean, 1968, that... I think it bears repeating, though, that this is a film that, again, 50 years ago, 4 years after the Civil Rights Act is passed into law, suddenly we're getting, yes, Jim Brown, who was a successful crossover figure in the first place, but, yeah, I mean, when you put it in its context, the idea of a movie like this coming out, and then we're being told, oh, Jim Brown, he's not just the heavy, he's the main character. He gets to act. He gets to outsmart everybody, you know? I think there's certainly a value in that.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. I would say that, you know, the film is, in its way, and as unintentionally as it was, I mean, there is something that feels like it is, you know, trying to push things forward in a degree, as dubious as some elements of it may be, given that this is still a production predominantly the result of a bunch of old white men behind the scenes here. And it's certainly, I mean, I wouldn't say that this is the most significant film of 1968 along these lines, because George Romero's Night of the Living Dead comes out at this point, and that film, I think, is far more concise in what it's doing and, you know, what it's trying to achieve there, and far more pointed in getting there than certainly The Split is. But then again, The Split is also, as we've repeatedly acknowledged, it's a big mainstream Hollywood film from MGM. So it's one of those things where you can't expect something as radical as what Romero and company were pulling off in Night of the Living Dead to come out of this movie.
Well, yeah, you get a certain freedom from working on the margins that you don't get working in the big leagues. But I mean, maybe that can kind of account for why this film seems to be so structured and yet so loose in some areas. Maybe it's a case where it's not so much that, like, they realized all the things that they could do on screen that they couldn't do back in the code days, as much as they realized that now was a time where you could start exploring the kinds of things that you could and couldn't get away with. And sort of without that, you know, sort of like the stone tablets of the don'ts and be carefuls. So instead, maybe this film is really more speculative than anything, where it's like, 1968, will audiences accept a black action star? Will audiences accept, like, a long, artfully shot sequence of a woman being murdered? Will audiences enjoy elliptical editing? Will audiences enjoy any of the other things we're doing? I'm like, I don't know, yeah. Like, this film seems to lose its train of thought and then pick it up in weird ways.
Yeah, so, I mean, on that level, I guess to sort of bring this to kind of a close, I mean, the film's interesting. Like, I would honestly recommend people see it because, you know, it is kind of an interesting artifact of the period it is. It's not the best adaptation of one of the Parker novels. It's certainly not the best film that everybody involved with it had made. I think Jim Brown would certainly go on to have more significant roles later on in his career. And, I mean, certainly in the case of Donald Sutherland, the dude was in Invasion of the Body Snatchers 1978. I mean, that's a pretty awesome trump card to have in your character in there. And Quincy Jones, like, well, we've previously explained what his career would go on to be from here.
And that little boy grew up to be Quincy Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... again, like, it's an interesting... This film is an interesting distillation of changes in style, changes in industry, changes in social composition, changes in terms of the audiences Hollywood is trying to cater to and attract. Yeah, like, it's... And again, like, it's also a lot of different people who would end up going on to much more notable things. And that being said, like, this film... It's not only interesting for its historical significance. Like, it's a tight little film. And, I mean, it's... I'm certainly never going to look back on it and be like, this was one of the best films I've ever seen, because I don't think it's ever trying to do that. But instead, we just have, like, a really, really great little potboiler of a film.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's all it really is. I mean, it's a decent little thriller. You can toss it in, you can enjoy it. I mean, if you're somebody who has sort of a love of that late 60s, early 70s, sort of brightly colored style, sort of pop color style looking film, this is a film that's got it. I mean, you're going to see some amazing jackets on the male actors in this film all throughout. Again, I really almost want to have Ernest Borgnine's yellow shirt and blue dinner jacket combo that he has when he's playing pool with Jim Brown later in the movie. It looks awesome.
Well, Christmas is coming.
There we go. But yeah, so, I mean, again, the film's available for Warner Archive. If you are somebody who's willing to take a chance on a blind buy, I'd say, you know, it's worth seeking out and giving it a shot. I don't think anybody's going to look at this and, you know, instantly regret it, necessarily. I know some fans of the Parker novels are less than taken with it because of its lack of faithfulness, but... it's definitely... I think you could definitely go back to the novel The Seventh and make a very different movie out of that now. That would also be interesting. But that's not to say that the one that was is a bad film, so... General recommendation? I guess...
Yeah, it's if you're listening to our show, watch this film. And with that, I guess before we split to our next destination, time for our patent pending antihistamines are starting to wear off bumper segment called Hits and Pits, where we take a up close look at some of the little things that we liked and loathed in equal measure. So, Dave, you had the pick, so I will give you first hit.
Watching Jim Brown kick Ernest Borgnine right in the stomach the minute he walks into a room.
Damn it, you actually stole even literally the wording I was going to use.
I mean, it is such a great introduction to that scene, but even going on as it turns into Jim Brown versus Ernest Borgnine stunt double, as the scene goes on, and there's a couple moments where you can blatantly see it, but that kind of feels fine for a movie like this. I mean, I don't mind it so much, but that's
like, wow, you think you would have shaved the beard on retakes or something. the world needs more movies where a scene begins with Jim Brown, who is not a small guy. I think he is incapable of sneaking, emerging out of literally nowhere to beat Ernest Borgnine to a pulp.
It is, yeah, it is a great, great start to that sequence, and one of the reasons you should see this movie. But, Andrew, anything, what would be your first hit here?
I would say, let's see, so we talked about the soundtrack, yeah, Ernest Borgnine. I would say that I really liked Donald Sutherland's character. Which may sound odd because, again, the characters aren't developed, but Dave, I think his name is, he's so, like, reserved and, like, has that, like, little smirk on his face. Like, he's basically a cat person with a bowl cut. And yet, because he looks so ridiculous and seems so aloof and detached, it just makes him so menacing. And, like, even during the heist scenes, it just, you know, it's... Almost at the same time that you, the viewer, are thinking, like, well, surely they're not going to sit there for 6 hours. Why would they do that? The camera then cuts beneath the desk to remind us, oh, hey, look, Donald Sutherland is smiling up at you, and he's holding a gun. So, I mean, he's believable. I think he's interesting. I think the dynamic between him and Brown is also pretty cool, because they're, you know, they're the two most sort of, like, soft-spoken, cards-to-the-vest kind of guys. Plus, he has the great line where... I'm trying to remember the context. I think it's when Warren Oates is basically, like, trying to bolt, and... Dave reminds him and says something to the effect of, the last time I killed a man, it was for $5,000. For $85,000, I could kill you 17 times.
Yeah, which is just a delightful, but yeah, scene there. And there's some great choice dialogue throughout this movie, from scene to scene.
You can definitely see the pulp roots of this film in certain parts, and lines like that really underscore it. But at the same time, it underscores why. I mean... pulp was never meant to be art, but every now and then it does something that everybody has to take notice of.
Absolutely. In my case, for the my second hit, we didn't really give Julie Harris a lot of mention in terms of her character of Gladys, who basically is Parker, as we sort of acknowledged at the start there, she's McLean's. The one that McLean runs to first, she sort of knows everybody and gets everybody in contact, and she's also a member of the gang and gets dispatched in a rather accidental method later on in the film. But, you know, her performance is sort of this one, this McLean's friend who also, you know, always constantly expresses regret that she has to beat him up in order to get her share. But she's still going to do it. She communicates that fairly well. And I always love just even her posture throughout scenes, and the way she's just sort of sitting there with the cigarette dangling from her hand and just looking over what's going on. It's just, she really, it's a small role, it's kind of a thankless role, but she's charming in it throughout.
Yeah, it's plausible why these, you know, these, the worst of the worst kind of criminals, why all these guys, well, like when she snaps her fingers, they all shut up and listen. You know, she wields that power over the group well.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, it's, again, it's a very minor role within the context of the overall film. But, again, considering that it's basically her and Diane Carroll are the only women actors in this film, you know, the fact that both of them make a great time with her, great impressions with the limited screen time they have is saying something, so...
Well, funny enough, that actually leads us to my next hit, which is Diane Carroll's performance. Because even though it's certainly shocking how Ellie exits the film, she does, as you say. She certainly makes the most of her screen time. And more importantly, she is positioned very much as McLean's equal. Like, she holds him accountable. She can shut him up. You know, she's not just the gangster's mole or... you know, the kept woman in this case. So, I mean, for all this film is about foregrounding, like, a new type of black masculinity on screen, there's also kind of a different kind of black femininity emerging, where it's not the nursemaid, and it's not the fallen woman, it's just, she is a black woman that wants to, you know, have her life be just so. And, you know, it would be great if McLean could fall in line with that, but, like, she's got no problem calling out BS when she sees it. And, yeah, I mean, I don't recall, and granted, I haven't seen every film ever made, but I don't recall seeing a lot of black actresses presented on screen quite in the manner that she is here. So I think that's also kind of significant in its own way. And again, I mean, in terms of, like, the human factor of this film and, like, having a reason to care about the characters, Diane Carroll and Jim Brown are the only actors who get that opportunity, and they both stick the landing on it.
No, absolutely. So, with that, I guess this brings us down to the pit segment here. So, I guess, Andrew, I'll throw this to you first. I mean, what would you say is a pit that we haven't sort of previously mentioned with this here, or that we want to reemphasize?
Normally, I hate saying, like, plausibility is a problem.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, I can buy the whole, well, we're camped out in the ticket office for 6 hours. I don't understand how McClane was able to build this highly sophisticated escape room and then lure Warren Oates in it via a prostitute so he lands just so that his foot is on this button. I'm just like, so if the same way that, like, McClane beating Kifka in, like, the drag race on Mulholland, it kind of begs the question of, like, well, if McClane is so much better than these guys at the things they do, why is he looking for them?
Yeah, it really is kind of the most dubious of those ones, because you can only sort of justify the notion of, okay, McClane's a good enough driver, he just wants to see whether, you know, Kifka is up for doing it, is up for that, because obviously he can't be at all places at once. Yeah, Marty, though, is just kind of, his test is weird. Really, really weird, particularly when you consider that, yeah, you know, where did, you know, he get the materials to do this? I mean, was that part of the budget for this entire scam? Like, and who is fronting the money exactly to put all this together?
Why wouldn't they just lure all the police and security at the arena with prostitutes and throw them in this room? Especially because Marty solves it by, like, taking his pants off and throwing them over a sensor. So it's like, the whole thing just comes off as, it feels very much like a scene from a different movie. And I mean, I know we've talked about other ones. This is the one where it feels most obtrusive, though.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong, because it does seem the most outlandish of the things, particularly when you get into the fact that otherwise a great deal of their approach to pulling off this crime is fairly realistic in terms of how it's being approached. I mean, yeah, they have to go out and they have to get their hands on machine guns, which is a delightful scene we never mentioned, where the front for where they buy this is at a toy store.
Which is
commentary. But yeah, it certainly is a significant pit in the film. For my first pick, I'm honestly, looking at the end of the, or towards the end of this film, the way in which Hackman is brought into this movie, I mean, the manner in which he's introduced is magnificent. But yeah, it feels a little late in the game to all of a sudden, and 30 minutes before the end, here's a brand new character that you've never met before. Toss it. Now, and again, kudos to them for getting Gene Hackman, who knows how to make an impression.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it also feels kind of like a bit of a cop-out, where it's like, okay, well, McClane's going into the climax, we want to root for him, and just in case anyone was on the fence about it, we're also going to get the one cop who's also a white dude and seems to have some kind of morality. We're going to team him up with him. So that way, it's like, just in case, the audience knows that it's okay to cheer for McClane.
But I like that you mentioned the idea of him having some sort of morality, even though, you know, he ends up stealing just as much money at the end of the day as McClane does.
But he does give it all back, except for $50,000.
Sure he does.
Exactly. It's okay, well, I won't ask any further questions. I have a plane to catch.
Yeah. But okay, so with that one there, what is your next pit here, Andrew?
Honestly, Dave, I don't think I have one. I mean, I could probably think of one. Maybe I'll put it on Twitter, but right now my brain is about to explode. So and not just because of how bonkers this film is at times. It's I think the cold meds are starting to wear off.
Understandable.
So, yeah, I mean, well, can I come up with anything? I don't know. Maybe it's just, no, you can't fault a film for for having a reach beyond its grasp. Better a diamond with a flaw than a pebble without. I think we basically covered most of my gripes with it. Do you have anything else?
Not really. It's, I mean, anything else is pretty much just minor nitpicks, like the aforementioned, you know, obvious body double or stunt double for Ernest Borgnine in fight scenes. But, again, we've already mentioned that. So, with that, Andrew, so that wraps up the split. Where are we going next episode?
Well, as we've mentioned, one of the key members of the group is horrid racist Marty Gow, played by the one Warren Oates. And we are going to be following him, actually, a year prior to this one, in a little film that he made, which also tried to foreground a different kind of black leading man, little film called In the Heat of the Night, starring Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger, widely regarded as one of the best, certainly one of the best police mystery films, and certainly a film with a very, very highly regarded place in the American film canon. Whether or not it still holds up 50 years after the fact, well, I guess you're going to have to tune in next week to find out.
Absolutely.
And in the meantime, Dave, where can people get in touch with us on Twitter and remind us that sick days are a thing?
You can remind us at I'm at 24 Panels. And what about you, Andrew?
And I'm at Filmstripper. As well, if you're looking to give a little bit of feedback and help us grow our audience at the same time, 5-star reviews on iTunes or your favorite podcasting service, that's always the best way to help promote the show and get some new eyes and ears on the product. But at the same time, it's also important that we know all the things that we're not doing and all the things that we're doing terribly. We can't make a better show if we don't know what's wrong. So your feedback is always important. And at the end of the day, we just want to make the kind of show that you folks at home want to keep listening to.
And if that advice is don't record when you're horribly sick, we understand. We'll take that under advisement for future episodes. So, with that, Andrew, I guess I have to ask the usual question. Do you have any parting words for our listeners?
Yes, David. Yes, I do. Remember, everybody, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Unless your landlord gets to you first.
Oh, it hurts to laugh.